Hello, everybody, and welcome to Minute 86 of Season 5 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is our maestro, David Brook, from Blueprint Review. Welcome back, David.
Sorry, I jumped in there too early.
No, that's okay.
It's good to be back.
Yeah, you always have to have a little bit of intro music, so it's fine. You know, it's just the intro music plays over, you know, the what we're saying. So that's okay also. You know, that works. So I once again want to thank you for doing the music. You know, it's been very helpful these past few seasons. And hopefully, you know, we'll be able to still continue collaborating in the future and find fun things to do. I like it. Yeah. Hopefully everyone listening also likes it, you know, and that. You know, this season was a very interesting choice, but I like it. You know,
yeah, it's an odd one because it's only really in the film, like in the one like little scene, isn't it? But it's
that's right.
Yeah, it gives me an excuse to play some lounge jazz, easy listening stuff.
That's right, and not just play it; you get to sing it also.
Oh yeah, any film with a bit of that in, I'll be there.
All right, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. That works. All right. So minute 86 begins with Barnes contacting Lorenzo and ends with Grant giving a cryptic order. Okay. So actually, you know, before we get into things, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background of this movie?
Oh, my background of this movie. Well, yeah, I mean, it's a film I watched. I can't remember the first time I saw it, but it will have been a long time. It'll be back in the probably the mid 90s. I was too young to watch it when it first came out of the cinema, because it was an 18 over here, or 15, I think it's an 18. So yeah, I was definitely too young when it came out. But yeah, caught it on video when I was of age. And yeah, I love it. I mean, I love the whole, I keep calling it a trilogy, but there's five now, I keep forgetting.
not really. We'll get there. I'm still on the fence as to whether, you know, how do we want to refer to this. I'm still referring to it as a trilogy with one good movie after it and one terrible movie. But I have a few seasons to worry about before I get to Die Hard the fifth one. You know, so I'm not really concerned at this point. You know, we're still what, 2 years away, 2.5 years away, for me to actually make a decision.
Yeah. I've got a feeling, to be honest. I wonder if, although I don't think I saw it first, but I think I kind of watched all the Die Hard films probably around the time the third one came out, maybe. I might be making this up.
Okay, well, Die Hard of the Avengers came out in 95. How old were you in 95?
Oh, 13. So I probably still wouldn't have seen it at the cinema, but I probably would have rented that out in probably 96 or 97.
Okay.
On video. I think it's probably around then I probably did all three, and I'm a fan of all three films. I enjoy them a lot. I've said before on this podcast and others that I do have a real soft spot for action movies. Although if you go on my website, I review all sorts of weird and wonderful stuff, but
they're mostly foreign action movies.
Kind of my go-to. Yeah, a lot of martial arts movies. They're my definite go-to. But before I got into kung fu films, I was really into my just kind of 80s and 90s action movies, Arnold Schwarzenegger movies and the Die Hard movies and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. And the first one is and will always be my favorite, I think. But as I say, the sequels, I think, really hold up. I haven't seen it for a long time until I was prepping for the podcast, really. I must admit, I've left it all a bit last minute. So it was... No, it wasn't last night. Sorry, the night before was my rewatch. And that's the first...
2 days is last minute? That's pretty good.
Well, no, I guess
not. No, I'm but saying yeah, if that... trust me, that's not last minute.
No, true. But I'm... yeah, and it really held up. It's, as I say, the first time I've seen it in, I don't know how long, 12 years maybe, something like that. It's been ages. And possibly longer. But it really held up. I enjoyed it a great deal. It's my kind of movie. I think it's a good, well-paced. It's got the story keeps you along, even though it's in essence is very much a rehash of the first film. It kind of brings in a lot of the same kind of beats and things. But it really holds your attention. I think there's quite a few, and we'll probably talk about this in one of the minutes. There's some nice little twists and turns in there just to keep you watching, a little bit of mystery here and there. And And that's what you need just for a good time at the movies, really. Decent characters, a decent plot, and some explosions. That's all I need. So it's good.
And that's what you get here. You know, it's I would say this is a little more than decent. You know, decent character and decent plot.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, this so if that's your bar, so this is above the bar. And oh, yeah, in my opinion.
No, yeah, yeah. I think I was talking more about the story and things. But, yeah, it's definitely more than decent. I think I reviewed it on Letterboxd after watching it the other night. And, yeah, I gave it a 4.5. I was tempted to maybe even go higher. So, no, I do rate it very highly. I think it's okay. A great film.
And I think deservingly so. You know, I'm a little biased here. But, yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
So we ended things on Friday with John and Lorenzo, you know, finally getting to their final stop. And, you know, assuming that if it's going to be anywhere, it's going to be this church. And, you know, they're eyeing this guy who happens to be walking, you know, around. Maybe he's out for a walk. Maybe he's possibly, you know, a sentry. No one really knows. And, you know, they left us where we're not really sure exactly what's going on. Then, you know, John's beeper goes off. And then he gets tackled by Baker. So that sort of gives it away what Baker really is. I mean, we obviously knew who he was because we've seen him earlier in this movie, but still. So this minute begins with Lorenzo with Barnes still trying to get in touch with Lorenzo, and he goes, "Lorenzo, it's Barnes." And then we only hear the voice, Lorenzo's voice, where he goes, "Where the hell did you go? Where's McLean?" And he goes, "He's with me. We're at the Highland Lake Community Church on the west side of the airport." "You're where? God damn it, you crazy idiot. Why didn't?" And then Barnes goes, "This must be their base of operations. Shut up and get your ass over here. Move it." So, I mean, I like the conversation between the two of them. But my first question is nobody noticed that McLean and Barnes were missing? You know, they're in this midst of trying to deal with stuff. Okay, let's assume they've been gone for a half hour. You know, you'd think that they would be missing them.
Yeah, although I guess it's pretty much carnage there at the minute. Everyone's trying to figure out what to do. So, I don't know, maybe not. Yeah, right. Who knows?
Right. And also, I mean, I think part of the problem is that we look at it from today's perspective, that everyone has a cell phone, but back then they didn't. So, like, you know, maybe if Lorenzo didn't see Barnes or John, he'd be like, okay, maybe they went to go to the bathroom or something like that. You know, like, you wouldn't necessarily think, oh, I'm going to call them on their cell phone to see where they are. You know, let's ping them to see where they are. It just doesn't really work that way. Mm. So maybe it's our, you know, the skewed view from, you know, 33 years in the future, where things are slightly different than they were back then. I don't know. And, you know, so he mentions that they're at the Highland Lake Community Church. Okay, now we've been here before. We saw, you know, when the bad guys took it over and all that stuff. But I decided to do a little bit of research to try and figure out, you know, what this place is, what's the real place that they're filming it in. Okay, this is actually what's funny is it really is called the Highland Lake Church, and it's located in Highland Lake, Colorado, and it's listed as one on the National Registry of Historic Places, and it celebrated 2 years ago 125 years since it was created. It's like near or since it was built. It's near the town of Meade in Colorado. Maybe friend of the show Todd Liebenow knows where that is. I don't know. You know, Todd, if you're listening and you know how far Meade is from where you are, it would be interesting. Meade or Highland Lake, either way. You know, and I found some really interesting things that, you know, it was built in 1896 and, you know, people were using it for 10 years without problems. And then they founded the town of Meade, which was nearby, and people started moving away to Meade from Highland Lake, and therefore less people, you know, were in the community to go to the church in Highland Lake, and they were going to the churches that were being built in Meade. And in 1917, they decided that they didn't have enough members in order to be able to pay their pastor and to upkeep the building. I guess, I mean, the guy who we saw, you know, at the beginning of this movie, looks like he's been there, you know, since 1917 also. You know, He looked like he was there very many years, and they actually closed it down in 1921, and they sold the place. Then they were trying to figure out what they were going to do about it and stuff like that. So what they ended up doing was is that they actually bought it for $1, and once they did
Wow.
that, they couldn't destroy it, because it was owned by somebody, even if they weren't dealing with it. And they actually decided to rebuild it almost 100 years later. So in 2008, it was completed, and they now actually have events there. So, I mean, obviously we know that when this movie was filmed in 1989, so the place was pretty much abandoned. Maybe they were just using it more, for movies and stuff like that. But the idea is that they now rent it out. You can rent it out for $750 for an event, which allows you to use the church and any external facilities they may have. And they're for that $750, they're willing to give you 3 days. The day before the event, the day of the event, and the day after, so that you can set up and clean up and all that stuff.
So the question is, has anyone had a Die Hard 2 night there, surely?
That, you see that that's the big question. I was trying to find that out and I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
They do have parking there for up to 30 vehicles, and you can get 100 people inside. So that maybe Stewart should have brought more men with him. They do funerals there also, and they give you a discount for that. It only costs you $300 if you want to do a funeral there. And they give you a handicapped porta potty, and the ability to run an electrical cord to the building next door in order to get electricity if you want to run small appliances or a microphone or things like that. I even found the name of the person you can contact if you want to do an event there. I was debating
Just
whether
give
to
him
call
like a
them up and say,
booking.
I want to do a
Yeah.
Die Hard event. Is that possible? Now in this website that I found that was talking about the history of the church, it does mention Die Hard 2 was filmed here. It says the church was used briefly in 1989 for the filming of the movie Die Hard 2. Producers paid for a new roof and built a fake entranceway with front doors and matching facade onto the rear of the building. So, right?
Was the I didn't pay enough attention to it, but are the interiors, are they studio, or could they have been at the church too? I don't know if
My.
I kind of feel like they'd probably be the studio,
Yeah, I
but
would think that there'd be a studio, especially since they're breaking windows and stuff like that. I don't think they really want to break
yeah, that's
the
true.
windows of the
Yeah,
store,
that's true.
but they just use it for the outdoor shots, I guess. But some of the
Yeah.
outdoor shots here, we're going to see it this week. They have some action outdoor shots that
Oh
are in front
yeah.
of there.
It sounds like it was a nightmare as well. Watching some of the making of, they had a lot of trouble because of the snow. You probably talked about this already on
Yes.
another episode,
What snow?
but yeah. Yeah, there was
That
no
was.
snow, so it's all fake and they had loads of mats and everything. It was just crazy. Yeah, it sounds like
Yes,
it's chaos.
completely chaotic.
But it was still really cold.
Yes,
But yeah.
that's true. So it's funny that he says that we're on the we're, when he when Barnes tells Lorenzo where they are, he goes, "We're at the Highland Lake Community Church on the west side of the airport." Like, who cares what side of the airport it is? Is
Maybe there's more than
maybe, and I was
one.
gonna say maybe there's one on the east side also. I don't know. And as the shot goes back, and we see Lorenzo as he's yelling into the phone, when he calls him "you crazy idiot," and we see him like scribbling on a notepad. And if you look on the desk or the table that he's at, there's like a fake plastic apple there,
What was that?
which I couldn't really.
Oh yeah, I thought it was a tomato for a minute. Yeah, it is an
No,
apple, yeah.
it is an apple that you can. And it's much brighter red than most apples would be. But I can see how you can think that's a tomato. Yeah, that's true. Now I
It's when I paused it and he couldn't see the bottom, yeah, but
that's
yeah.
right.
No, it's
But
definitely.
did you try pausing to see what Lorenzo writes on the pad?
Oh no.
So I did, and there is no way that he is writing anything that Barnes told him.
Looks like a number.
No, it doesn't even look like a number. It's just scribbles. But there's no way that he wrote there the word Highland Lake Community Church, west side of the airport, anything. It's just if you like pause it at 11
Oh
seconds,
yeah, I can
you
pause it
can
now,
see
yeah.
part of it, and he's just they're long words, but they're not the same words.
Shorthand, maybe? Probably not.
Probably not, but
He's not a journalist.
it's just very weird. what he's doing. And, then I think it's pretty rude of what, Grant does here. Grant just takes the pad from him, and
it's actually,
ripped the page off of it.
Yeah, this slightly hints as to what happens next, maybe as well, because he kind of takes it, not even really asking what it is. I mean, he's not listening to the phone call.
That's right.
So that kind of gives a bit of a hint towards the fact that he knows where he's going, and it's all a sham sort of thing.
Correct. That's true. And also, like you said, he doesn't read it, and then he says, "We know where they are." So maybe he has telepathy. He knows where. Yeah. First of all, how does he know that he should be taking the pad? How does he know, he's not in the shot up until this point. We don't see that he's nearby, and Lorenzo says, "Barnes, where are you? And where's McClane?" He doesn't hear Barnes say back, "McClane's with me." I don't know. It's a little strange the way that works out there. Mm. And then as Grant takes the page, he then says, "Code Red, sit rep. We got positive ID on Stewart's location. Let's move." So first of all, he's just throwing out a whole bunch of different, military terms here, which mean very little sense in the context here. All right. But first of all, let's go with the fact that he says we have positive ID on Stewart's location. Now, no one says anything about that. Where does he get that? Where's the positive idea? We have maybe suspected ID. We might think that this is where they are. I don't know, but it's not. There's no way that he knows for sure at this point. Mm. And he's asking for a sit rep. When you say sit rep, it's like, okay, situation report. So, it's something that you're usually asking someone to give you a report. It's not. It doesn't make any sense in this concept. Context. And then the last thing I want to go on talk about, which is actually the first thing he says code red. Okay, now do you know what code red means?
Not really, like a nuclear bomb or something, I don't know.
Okay, so I mean, I looked this up, and there's we'll get to the military terminology of code red at the end, but I just want to say, so a code red is possibly a hospital emergency code and things like that, right? But depending on which hospital you are and what country you are, the whole idea is that they didn't have uniform codes, at least at this point. In 2003, the state of Maryland began to mandate that hospitals have to have uniform codes because, you use different colors for different things. They can mean so many different things. So they actually created a whole list of codes that are now used over the entire U.S., for like different types of color codes. Okay, so I'll just go through some of them and see if you've heard of any of them. Okay, do you know what an amber alert is or a code atom? Okay, so that's a child abduction. That's a child abduction alert. All right, code black means it's a bomb threat. Code blue is usually someone has problems with the heart or respiratory problems. Usually you'll hear that in movies and TV shows that are dealing with someone having a heart attack in the airport, and they go code blue in room 215 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Okay. Code brown is used to indicate severe weather, which I don't know. That's very strange. It's like weather is code brown. I don't know. Let's go again. Code clear means that the emergency is done. Code gray is someone who is there's a combative person that's there. Someone's being abusive to patients, family, visitors, staff, or physicians. If they have a weapon, then they call that a code silver. Hyo silver. I don't know. He's got silver bullets. Code green means emergency activation. Code orange, hazardous spills. Code pink, infant abduction or pediatric emergency. All right. Code white is a neonatal emergency. An aggressive person in the hospital, in some hospitals, an aggressive person is called a code violet. And then we have code red. What is code red? What do you think it would be?
I don't know. Life-threatening situation. Oh, I guess how much this could be.
Code red means a fire.
Fire, oh.
There was actually a TV show in the early 1980s called Code Red with, I think, Lorne Greene and Adam Rich. from It Is Enough, you know, who just passed away earlier this year. And right, so they, and a code red could also mean that there's massive hemorrhaging of a woman in the delivery room. So, okay, I mean, it makes sense. But again, none of those make any sense.
Nothing to do with terrorist for what, locations.
Exactly, for what Grant is saying here. Okay, now, have you ever heard, and I'm assuming the answer is no, have you ever heard of the name David Vernon Cox?
No.
Have you ever heard the term code red in a military situation, possibly in a movie or play?
I think I've probably heard code red in movies before, yeah.
No, well, no, in a military movie where someone is performing a code red.
Probably. Well, I don't know if I'm sure I've heard them say code red before, but who knows?
Okay, well, are you familiar with Aaron Sorkin plays or movies?
Yeah.
A Few Good Men.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
I haven't seen it for a while, but.
Yeah. Okay, so a code red is basically, you know, when you actually, you know, when it's a disciplinary action. You know, when, you know, that's what they basically did. And, you know, when they stuffed the rag down his throat, they were performing a code red and stuff like that. So David Vernon Cox was a Marine who Aaron Sorkin actually based his play A Few Good Men on what happened to David Vernon Cox. He was in the Marines, and he was stationed in Guantanamo Bay. And while he was there, right, he was assigned to guard the perimeter that was separating the base from the country of Cuba. And he said that he belonged to an unofficial group of Marines known as the 10, okay, who basically were people that were doing all of these exercises, like running exercises with full gear in 110 degree heat, and that to hang from 60-foot towers, and, you know, for things like that. So while he was there, there was a private named William Alvarado who wrote letters to his congressman complaining of the poor conditions and illegal activities on the base. And he even claimed that there were Marines that were firing shots over the fence line into Cuba. And Alvarado requested a transfer off the base. Okay, the information eventually reached the commanding officer, Colonel Samuel Adams, who decided that because of the violation of the chain of command, I mean, this, I'm amazed when I'm reading this, how close it is to the story of A Few Good Men. I mean, you said it's been a while since you've seen it, so I don't know how much you remember about it, but it's just unbelievable. I always thought it was completely made up. I didn't realize how close to the truth it really was. Okay.
No, yeah.
So apparently the group known as the 10 were encouraged to punish Alvarado for what was viewed as dishonorable conduct. They performed a code red on him, and that's basically hazing by the Marines. And obviously it is also against Marine Corps policy to do so. What they did was is they restrained him at night. They binded him with tape and stuffed a pillowcase in his mouth. And he was blindfolded, and, you know, he was assaulted while being dragged out of the room. The plan was to shave his head, and something went wrong and he began choking, and his lungs filled with fluid, and he spat up blood and began turning purple as he then lost consciousness. They stopped it, and they called for help. And then he was transferred to a hospital in Miami, where he actually went on to make a full recovery, unlike in the movie and the play where he died. Group of 10 admitted that they did it, and they were all arrested for what they, you know, for what they did. So basically they were given the option of a plea bargain, which would dishonorably discharge them. 7 of the 10 accepted the plea, including the platoon leader. And the platoon leader was the only one who was actually able to get an honorable discharge for that. All the others were,
yes.
And so Aaron Sorkin's sister, Deborah Sorkin, was the judge advocate that in the JAG Corp that was sent to defend them. So she actually told her brother about this whole story, and he used it, you know, for the play. So Cox and two other Marines decided to stand trial, and they claimed that they didn't do anything wrong because they were following orders of their commander, and that they did not have any, they were not attempting in any way to murder him or anything like that. He eventually was court-martialed and just for a few days, and they were cleared of murder and conspiracy charges. And then he ended up spending 38 days in the brig, and you know, it was time served, and he was then honorably discharged from the Marines in 1989. So again, it's just really cool how close the real story is. I mean, the story in the movie is obviously a little more interesting because he ends up dying and stuff like that. I'm very glad that in real life that didn't happen, you know. So, you know, just very interesting the way they did it. Actually, the guys who were part of this assault actually sued Castle Rock Entertainment for taking their idea, you know, for like basically stealing their life stories without getting any real any money for doing this.
Yeah. Plus, it kind of made them look good by making it even worse that he dies.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So it's just very interesting the whole story and stuff like that. Because I mean, the story keeps going on. I'm not even going to go into it. Where this guy Cox actually ended up disappearing, and he was found murdered later on. From what I understand, it's an unsolved case. They don't know who murdered him. So it is possible that maybe, you know, Alvarez wanted to get some revenge or something like that. You know, that nobody really knows what it was related. So,
crazy.
Yeah, and again, this happened 25 years ago, and they still don't know who did it. They even reopened the case and were never able to figure it out. So it is an unsolved mystery of what happened to it. So again, I have absolutely no idea what Grant is referring to here when he says it's a code red, because I don't think they're going to go beat up anyone or anything like that. I don't think that's the plan. Maybe.
Or maybe it's a further clue to their kind of dodgy outfit. Maybe that's their own code for let's go and do what we're supposed to do and
that's true.
And get the bad guys off.
Right. No, it makes you wonder. Like, I mean, again, I'm assuming that most people who are listening to this have seen the movie. So, you know, the question is, what is the real plan with Grant? You know, like, how did they think the whole thing was going to play out? Because it's not Grant that eventually found them at the community church. It's John. You know, so were they expecting to find the church? You know, what was the original plan of when they were going to meet up and, you know, deal with these type of things? So you're right. Yeah. Maybe code red means, all right, code red, we're moving out. We're going to go move along with the plan. I don't know.
Unless they were only going to go, unless they were there just in case that happened. And if nobody found the church, they'd just carry on as though they're not, they'd just carry on as normal. I don't know.
Right.
Who knows? It is odd. There's another thing. I guess we might come to it later. But I found as well, in terms of the bad guy's plan, is that the Franco Nero character, the general,
Esperanza.
He doesn't seem to have a clue what's going on.
Right, like, no, we'll get there. We'll talk about that. Okay. That later this week we have. Actually, it's later today. Sort of. Well, it comes up today and again tomorrow.
He shows it briefly. He shows it briefly. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that type of thing. And then you know, one of the Marines screams "Yo!" Another one says "Yes, sir." Which is just very interesting the way they do that. And then you know, the shot changes and we're back to the fight with John and Baker. And Baker then slams John into the garage wall, and there are like all these garbage cans that fall down. And then Baker then starts to get the upper hand. And then we as they're fighting, the shot changes, we're back in the church itself. And we get a quick shot of Burke. Do you recognize who plays Burke?
Burke. Is Burke the general?
No. Burke is just one of the bad guys.
Oh,
Burke is the one who is leaning over and
Oh, I've just looked it up there. Wow, John Leguizamo. I didn't realize
that's that. Right. John Leguizamo. He's bandaging up or tending.
Oh yeah,
gotcha. Tending to Esperanza's wound, which is really funny because it looks like there's like a bandage and then like a piece of tape, you know, on his arm. Not even, maybe it's medical tape or something like that, but still, you know.
Yeah, there's loads of familiar faces hiding in this.
Oh, for sure. Like,
yeah, Robert Patrick and Colm Meaney and all this kind of stuff. It's,
that's right.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's a great cast.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I've picked up on a whole bunch of others that most people wouldn't even know anywhere from other things.
Well, I forgot that Franco Nero was in it as well. I think, well, when I watched it when I was a kid, I probably didn't know who he was, to be honest.
Okay.
But yeah, I didn't realize he was in it either.
And then, we have Stewart say, our escape plan will be ready. Our escape plane will be ready within 30 minutes, General. Now, how does he even know that? I mean, like, we haven't mentioned anything lately about the cargo plane ever since, you know, they got Esperanza. They did say a plane will be landing in 58 minutes, you know, and we want this stuff, but they never really gave us a time frame as to when this plane will be ready and stuff like that. So it's very strange the way he says it. You know, then we hear all these like background noises, which are maybe like planes talking, the chatter, you know, over the different equipment that they have there or something like that. And then as Esperanza takes a cup of coffee that he's being offered, he goes, if there are no more surprises. So, I mean, I'll touch a little bit on what you just said earlier, like a few minutes ago. It goes back to what we were talking about in the original Die Hard. There are certain things that the main bad guy knows that nobody else knows. You know, he's keeping certain things, you know, secret. So we can assume from this that Esperanza doesn't know that there are another 12 guys that are part of their group.
It's weird, though, because you would have thought that Esperanza is really his Stuart's superior. You kind of feel like Stuart would tell him.
He's not his superior.
Or
he's not a superior. He's the guy paying them to for the escape.
Oh, okay, just like a mercenary. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, yeah. True.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't think, And then the shot changes, and we get a shot of five police cars and a transport truck that are like rushing towards the scene. And then we're inside one of the trucks, and you can count 9 soldiers that can be seen in there, plus Grant, and then plus Telford. Telford is the radio guy, who I've mentioned this a few times already. But do you know that he's married to Rebecca De Mornay?
No. Wow. Lucky man.
Apparently, yes. And then Grant says something very strange. He goes, gentlemen, we have a situation here. And, you know, as he says that, you see all of his men start putting clips into their guns that have blue tape on them. Now, it's very strange. If you were to look at the beginning of this minute when they were in the room with Lorenzo, they all have magazines in their M16s, but those magazines don't have any colors on them. You know, no blue, no red, no nothing. I mean, it's just they're blank. Mm. So I'm trying to figure out the timeline here. So they all have clips in their guns. They get into the truck. They all take their clips out, and then they're waiting to get the order from Grant to put the blue clips in. It's just something doesn't make sense there. You know,
maybe it's dangerous to have them on in the car at first.
I'm familiar with weapons. I'm assuming that you were probably not. A magazine in an M16 is very safe as long as you haven't, you know, put a bullet in the chamber. You know, and even then, if you put in a bullet in the chamber, you still have, you know, you can put it on the safety. But my assumption is they're just walking around without bullets in the chamber. But again, it's just very strange that you would take them out when you're going into a truck, if you're on your way to an assault. You know, that type of thing. And that's all I have for this minute. Do you have anything else for this minute before we get into the script?
Where are my notes? I've lost my notes. I kind of briefly mentioned some of the things. I think what this minute shows, because it jumps around between a lot of characters, is something I mentioned earlier about how I love the cast of the film. And it reminds me of one of the things that I was kind of raving about when I talked about Die Hard 1, is I do like the fact, and Die Hard 2 does this as well, is they kind of flesh, maybe less so, like, in Die Hard 1, pretty much all of the goons had their own kind of tiny little story arcs and things, and there's less of that here, but what this still has is a lot of kind of side characters that are given time to shine in a way, like they're given some quirks, they're given some good lines. And there's quite a few of them show up in this 1 minute, which is nice. Although I guess these are probably bigger roles really, but it just adds more fun to the film. You're not just like one bad guy, one good guy, and then some cannon fodder. You've got a lot of people to kind of keep you interested and keep you laughing or keep you feeling threatened or whatever. It's an
right. Ultimate. Especially when looking at it, you know, 33 years later, because then we actually recognize many of them, which at the time we wouldn't have recognized. We wouldn't have said, hey, there's John Leguizamo, you know. No one would have said that back then.
We just talked about the clips as well, but I think, that's obviously foreshadowing what's going to come later. But it's done quite nicely in terms of, I mean, when watching it back again, it's not giving it away, but obviously it's a big hint, and it's something you might not necessarily see. I mean, because they have the little stickers on. But at the same time, I think it works well in the film in terms of it adds that bit of mystery. So you do notice it when you first watch it. You go, oh, why are they putting that certain colour on? So it does, again, it kind of keeps you hooked, keeps you intrigued. Right. Which is a nice little
touch. Did you remember the twist?
No, I didn't remember that. No, I didn't. It's, as I say, it's been ages. I said 12 years. I'm thinking 20. I don't know. It's been a long time.
Okay. All right. That's fair. So the script is pretty much the same. I mean, one of the things that they talked about in the script that we discussed on Friday is the fact that it takes Barnes a really long time to find a place where he got a signal so that he can call Lorenzo. And then, you know, they give us a shot from inside the church out through the window, saying through the rear window here, we see the fence give and bend again, but the sound is muffled by the wind in the glass, meaning that if someone were to be looking out the window from the church, they would see John and Baker fighting. You know, they give us like an external view of the whole thing. It works well the way they did in the movie, but it's just been really very interesting. And then it says the airport police office, Lorenzo writes as Grant reacts. You're where, you crazy idiot? Why didn't you? Barnes down the block, standing on a snow-covered car. Just get here. This is it. Move your fat ass, will you? Grant signals the sergeant, and then it's like D-Day as all the soldiers and some cops hustle out. McLean and Baker halfway to their feet, the snow bloody between them. Baker karate kicks McLean back into a tree, dazing him. Baker jumps in, rips McLean's coat open, and grabs for the holster. As his hand comes up empty, McLean grins, headbutts him. Airport police cars and the army truck skid around a corner. Soldiers on the benches, Grant standing, rocking like a commuter. Telford, only one who's unarmed, still monitoring the radio. Gentlemen, we have a situation here. Click, click, snap. Ammo clips are broken out. All piggybacked like combat-hardened troops do it. Two banana clips taped together with blue tape. Okay, piggybacked meaning you have two clips taped together. So that it's easier to switch them around. Exactly. All right, so every Monday we have a segment called McLean Monday, where my guests will give their top five Bruce Willis performances. So what have you got for us, David? Start with your number five and work your way up.
Okay, so my number five, I've gone for one. It's another one that I've not seen for a while. And most of my picks, I've picked more for kind of films that I love, maybe more than Bruce Willis' performances. Although this one I've tried to put in there, although I do enjoy this film quite a lot. But again, it's been a while. But I've gone for Death Becomes Her. I think mainly because I do remember Bruce playing quite a different character than he normally does and kind of pulling it off. And it's a film I have fond memories of. I used to enjoy it a lot. But as I say, it's been a while since I've seen it. But I thought it was a lot of fun back when I did.
Yeah, I recently rewatched it. I don't think it holds up as well, but the special effects are amazing in the movie.
Yeah, that's it. I can remember, especially as a teenager, when I saw those first time at the cinema, it was just blew me away. So yeah, then number four, I'm going to go with Looper, which is a film I like a great deal. I think it's got a clever concept, and you get to see two versions. You get there's Bruce Willis, and then there's
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt. That's it. Yeah, playing a young Bruce Willis with kind of weird makeup to make him look a bit like him, which is a bit weird. But it's a great film. I like that a lot. So I had to make the list. Then at number three, I have 12 Monkeys. I'm a sucker for kind of time travel movies. I guess that's why I like Looper as well. But I think I can remember at the time Brad Pitt got a lot of acclaim for his role. I think he got an Oscar nomination, didn't he, as well? But I watched it again a couple of years ago, and I actually found Brad Pitt to be a little on the kind of over the top side. But I think Bruce Willis is underrated in that film. Like he plays it down a bit, but he does a good job, and it's a great film. I enjoy it a lot, so that's why I put that in there. Number two, I've got Pulp Fiction. It's a great film, and Bruce Willis has fun with it in his role there. Obviously, the film jumps around between stories, so he's not like front and center the whole time, but his scenes are very memorable, and I think he does a great job. And then finally, number one's Die Hard. I love Die Hard. It had to be in there, an obvious choice, but and it's just an iconic role for him, really. I think it is what made Bruce Willis kind of, it wasn't the first thing he was in, but it was the first kind of international success he had in film.
Right.
And it did that for a reason. He's perfect in it, and it's an amazing film.
I agree with you on that one, which is why I covered that two seasons ago.
Yep.
All right, great. So you want to tell people how they can get in touch with David Brooks?
Yeah, if you head over to blueprintreview.co.uk, you'll find all my movie reviews and such. And if you look up Blueprint Review on Facebook and Twitter and things like that, you'll find me there too.
All right, great. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, or you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here